Okay, let's see if we can find a theme that will take us through the many issues that Rosh Hashanah Rabbah raises. You know that many things to tie together here. It's the seventh day of Sukkot. That's one issue. What is the meaning of the last day? What's the meaning of the fact that it's the seventh? Why is it connected to the persona of David HaMelech, King David? What does that mean? Why is it the day of Mashiach? In as much as it is the day of David, of all the Ushbizin, it is David HaMelech, and David is Mashiach. There's a Siddur. Is someone have a Siddur somewhere? Thanks. You know the Tfilas Kol Peh, Max of you. Thanks. You see, the Hoshanas that we say tomorrow, we actually identify very explicitly the fact that the Mashiach is David. There's a Gilgul. It's him in Ben David reappearing. It's clear that David was the... Thank you very much, India. David HaMelech is the persona of Mashiach. And there are many ways to demonstrate that, but I mean, here's a very clear way. In the Hoshanas, we say at the very end, just before the Chibut Arava, the beating of the Arava, which is something that don't intend to speak about. That's for the black belt Kabbalists after midnight. Perhaps we'll just touch on it a little bit. We say that we take the Arava, right? Put down the loaf, take the Arava, and then as we go around, we definitely talk about David and Mashiach. Because they call Doidi Hinei Zeba, my beloved, the voice of my beloved is I hear her approaching, him, her approaching. We'll see. This is actually a female day. And the whole paragraph, the final one, just before we do that ancient custom of the Nevi'im, which involves Arovas and none of the other four species, we talk here about Mashiach and David. We say, he comes in the multitude of his the throng of all those who come with him, Lama Rahazesim, to stand on the Mount of Olives. Gishta b'shefa liska, he's coming in this with, accompanied by the sound of the shofar, which again is one of the simanim, one of the 10 reasons that's always brought from Rav Sadia about the shofar, is that it's the sound of the crowning of a king. The Mashiach is the final king. Tachtav har yibokah, the mountain will split under him. This is a reference to the Navi who says that in the final messianic showdown, the mountain will split in half. One half the mountain will move east, one will move west. We'll hear the announcement, as it was, all the holy ones who are coming with him. All those who come into the world, all human beings, baskol yishman va'elam, a baskol will be heard, a reverberation of a sound from another world. Zera musay rechamoy, those who are born from his womb. Not again, just talking about male and female, but Nolduki Yeled Mima Imu, like a child being born from his mother's womb, this is a rebirth. Chalav Yalda Mizois, she will tremble in birth pains. Right, there's a reference to the pasuk that's Chalav Yalda Sion, that Sion is the woman giving birth. The birth of Mashiach. Mashiach is always called Chevle Mashiach, it's always called the birth pains of Mashiach. And therefore, we talk here about labor pains, which is the Jewish people, in a sense, being reborn. Mishama kazos, who has ever heard of such a thing? In other words, this is a completely new phenomenon in the world. Taipal kol ele, the one who is pure, has brought about all of this. And Mira, who has ever seen such a thing? This is a new phenomenon, a new world. Yesha uzman huchad hayuchal eretz beyom echad. Can this is a unique day on which the world is, so to speak, is about to give birth? Im yivaled goy pam echas. A nation being born once, as it were, this is the culmination, the fulfillment of the original birth of the Jewish people. Le'es yigal amoy noy v'hayu le'es erev yir. At evening it will be light. In other words, this is a fulfillment of the prophecy that the final coming of Mashiach will be a night that will be a day, just like Yetzias Mitzrayim was not a night and not a day, or rather a night that is a day. It's a night that's not dark. The darkness of night no longer applies. Which is why Yetzias Mitzrayim, this is a throwback to Yetzias Mitzrayim. The night of going out of Mitzrayim has the din of a day, right? You know that we say halal at night, which we don't ever do on any other occasion. Lo yom v'lo. This is a night that's actually a day. Moishim yalu lahar tzion, the redeemers. Little problem here. Who are the moishim? Who are the redeemers? Plural. Ki chala gam yalda tzion. Tzion is giving birth now. Nishma bechol gvuleich. It will be heard throughout all your borders. Harchivi mekom alek. Widen the borders of your tent, as it were, because your children are coming home. The mother now is going to widen the ambit of her home so that her children can all come home. All of these things need discussion. Why does she have to widen her, open her home? We have a principle that Yerushalayim was never too small for all those who came there. There's a whole subject in its own right. But it's clearly a mother figure here. You can't miss the fact that this is a female idea. Simi adamesek mishkan esayach. Put down your place of dwelling all the way to Damascus. Wouldn't tell the Syrians about this. But that's part of the borders of Eretz Yisrael. Kabli banayich ibn esayach. Receive your sons and daughters, all in the feminine. Ilzi chavatzeles Hashem. Rejoice the lily of the Sharon. All of these are Kabbalistic references and references to Psukim. Ki kamu yushene chevron. Because those who sleep in Chevron are awakening. The Medrash in a famous Medrash, which is the known as the base of Medrash, an ancient collection of Midrashim, says that when the Mashiach comes, he will go to Hebron and wake those who sleep there. He'll awaken the Avos who are sleeping in Hebron. He'll call to them and waken them. They will arise from their graves and they'll be followed by everyone arising. There's a place in Tikkuni Zohar that says that all Tchias HaMaasim will take place from the Machpelah, right? Not only the tradition we have that the people who are buried will make their way underground through Masilis, through the tunnels underground, until they come up in Eretz Israel. So there the Zohar says that they will come up from Hebron. That will be the place of the resurrection. So it begins with the Avos that the Mashiach is awakening. Ilzi Chavasel Hashem, ki kam is a Pnu Elai. Vehivashu, turn to me and be redeemed. Hayom im bekoli. Today, if you listen to my voice, Tzamach ish Tzemach Shmoi, there has been flourishing, there is now flourishing or blossoming a man whose name is Tzemach, who David ba'atzmoi. This is David. Why David is called a Tzemach, all of these details need long explanation. Why do we refer to David as Tzemach? Tzemach means a blossoming or a flowering. One of the reasons that Mashiach or David is called Tzemach is because one of the characteristics of plants, among many others, is that they grow by what appears to be disintegration. The seed falls off the plant and appears to be detached from the plant where it can have no source, sustenance, drawing life. Then it falls into the ground, no hope of surviving because it's not attached to its place of growth. And in fact, as soon as it's buried, it begins to disintegrate. And when the seed has begun to rot and disintegrate, unexpectedly and paradoxically, at that moment, a new shoot sprouts. And that's exactly the pattern of Mashiach. Mashiach is always going through those phases of history that look like he's doomed, right? Mashiach is always appears to be doomed, both in fact and in spirit. That means that he appears to be doomed because there appears to be no way he can survive. And it appears that he can not exist as a spiritual entity because he's always caught in the throes of spiritual darkness. You see those two themes very clearly. The clearest example is that David has no life of his own. The Medrash says, the Gemara says, that he was destined to be a stillborn child. The source for this is that Hashem took Adam Arishon and he showed him Dor Dor V'Doshav. He showed Adam Arishon all the future generations. He gave him an oversight of what all his descendants would be. And when Adam Arishon saw David, he saw a newborn child who was only going to live for 3 hours. So he said to Hashem, Ashu asked who that was, and Hashem said, David, and Adam Rishon said, give him of my years. And that's why he lived only 930 years, and not the destined 1,000. Talking about 1,000 after the Chet. Before the Chet, he was going to live forever. After the Chet, 1,000 years, but instead of living 1,000 years, he lived 930. So you see, and David lived exactly 70, right? Exactly to the day, he lived 70 years, again 7. Right? He's the 7th of the Shpizin, and he lived exactly 70 years. He is the one who was destined not to live at all. He doesn't even have life of his own. He's completely empty. He doesn't even have a life of his own. His years are given from Adam. There's many resonances in that. One of the meanings is he has no life of his own. He lives only of a gift of life from someone else. And the other facet of that, of course, is his gift of life from Adam. In the sources in Kabbalah, what's written is that Adam is the letters of Adam, or Adam David Mashiach. Adam, that Yari brings, is Adam David Mashiach. That is the three, that's the Briah HaTichon, that's the straight, the bar that links all of history, begins with Adam and finds its completion in the Mashiach. And who is that link? None other than David. David comes to his fruition, as it were, fulfillment in Mashiach. So that if Adam had not gone wrong, he would have been all the humanity that was meant to be. But now that he goes wrong, he re-manifests in a corrected form as David. David fails to bring that to perfection. He brings it almost to perfection, but because of his error, the Gemara says it's because the Gemara says that David's mistake was that his mistake was that one afternoon he said to Hashem, "Why do we not say Elokei David? Why do we, as a Jewish people, we say Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob? Why don't we say Elokei David?" This question needs to be understood. Obviously, it sounds in a very amateur approach. It sounds like Gaiva. Right? Of course, David is the exact opposite of Gaiva. He comes to teach the absence of Gaiva in the world. He comes to teach emptiness of spirit or ego, and that's what we'll try to focus on this evening. That, I think, is going to be the common theme here. But he says to Hashem, why don't we say, in other words, in servitude and in a spirit of what have I not done for you, what do you require of me, that your name can be said together with mine in the world? And Hashem said to him that those fateful words, the reason the Jewish people say, Elokei Avraham, my name is set together with Avram's, and my name is set together with Yitzhak's, and my name is set together with Yaakov's, is because they were tested. Inu is nasu lefana. They were tested, and you've never been tested. And then David said those critical and doomed words, b'chaneinina v'naseini, test me. And that's where he failed. Now we have to understand why his failure lay in asking for a test. You know, those who speak about this don't... Bathsheba, the test was with Bathsheba that evening. By the way, Bathsheba, you know, means the daughter of seven. And in Kabbalah, David's name is Bathsheba. This theme of seven, yes, which is tonight, is the seventh night, that crops up again and again. But it seems that the error was not the technical error of sinning with Bathsheba in the simple fashion. She was divorced, as we know. Uri had given a divorce and he had a death sentence on him. This all made plain in the Gemara. But the real mistake was asking Hashem for a test. We have to understand why that that dooms his historical fulfillment as being the completion of Adam. Why is that broken by his asking for a test? And why then does he fail the test? It's mashma in our sources that he deliberately failed when he realized that he'd erred in asking for a test. This is all part of the same discussion. But all goes around the fact that you see Tzemach Ish Tzemach Shmoi has blossomed and flourished or flowered a man whose name is Tzemach. So you see that the first point here is that Mashiach is David. Who David Ba'atzmoi? The second point you see is that he had no life of his own. He was completely empty of life. Namely, he was destined to die within hours of his birth and he was given life from outside. And thirdly, you note in the pattern of Mashiach that he has no ability to... He goes through all the parts of history that look the worst, the seamiest and the most sordid. You see that his path through history is always what looks the worst. Then we don't have time this evening to trace it, but just to put a hint to it, is that David begins, his seed passes through history in the very worst possible or the most anti-spiritual places, right? The Medrash says, yes, Matsasi as David Avdi, I found David my servant, I found him, Heichan Mitzasiv, where did Hashem find him? In Stoim. Where did Hashem find him? In Stoim. Meaning that the original appearance of the seed of Mashiach is when Lot sins, or Lot has a relationship with his daughters, in the eye of the storm. That means as Stoim is being destroyed, and Lot is living in that cave, right, on the border of the destruction, when according to their understanding, the whole world has now been eliminated, at least that's what the girls thought. The only human beings alive, as far as they know, Lot and his daughters, and the older one decides that the proper course of action here is to do what's called Avera Lishma. She's now going to do a sin for the right reason. There the Gemara says in Nazir, the Gemara says that a sin done for the right reason, and gives this as an example, is greater than a mitzvah done for the wrong reason. Right? She thought she was going to have a relationship with the father to bring children into the world, because in fact, there are no men in the world, and therefore the human race comes to an end. And what Hashem requires from us here is the very strange effort of having a relationship with our own father in order to bring children to the world. If you think about this for a moment, it's really no different than what Adam, what did the first generations of the world have to do in the first place? They had to have a relationship with their own close relatives, right? Brothers and sisters. There were no other human beings. It's a replay of that phase of history. But be that as it may, they are. So it appears that, and from that relationship, Mashiach is born in both ways, both of the girls. What happens is from those two children, those two daughters, Ammon and Moav, were born. Moav is the one born from the older daughter. Moav, he has the sordid label. His name means from my father, right? Shameless, not only the act itself, but shamelessly naming him for a product of a relationship with the father. And Ammon gave rise to what the Goram calls shtei praidos, these two, whoever they were, these two women, namely Ruth on the one hand, and now two of them who came out of that relationship, one who married or became the great-grandmother of King David, and one who married Shlomo. And out of that, both on the line of Mashiach is born. So from this relationship that he has with his daughters, very problematic and seamy and sordid on the outside, Mashiach has been born. And that pattern continues throughout history. Yehuda and Tamar, ten generations later, well, when you count the generations, you see that Yehuda ends up having a relationship with his own daughter-in-law, thinking she's a prostitute, doesn't know who she is, she's disguised, ends up having a relationship with her externally, something of the most humiliating, internally, the mitzvah of Yibum. Lot and his daughter, externally a very low act of incest, internally an Avera Lishma. Yehuda and Tamar, a relationship between two people who looks like the most sordid and humiliating. The real challenge to Yehuda was, would he even be able to admit such a thing? And internally turns out to be that he's actually fulfilling the mitzvah of Yibum with her. And the same thing continues time after time. David HaMelech himself is born in that way. You know that, I'm sure you're familiar with the story, is that his father had separated from his mother because the old accusation that since Yishai was born from Rus, two generations later, the accusation was that since Rus was from Moav, and Moabites are not allowed to marry into the Jewish people, and the whole debate was, did it apply only to men, or men and women as well? And in his day, there were those who accused him of being completely spiritually illegitimate because he's born from a woman who should never have married into the Jewish people. And in deference to that opinion, he separated from his wife. But she knew, just like Tamar, again, a throwback to the same story, just like Tamar knew that this was a marriage that was meant to be. So David's mother disguised herself and hid herself and pretended to be a woman, a slave woman that he was allowed to marry. And in fact, unknown to him, he was marrying his own wife, right? Unknown to him. And of course, later when David's mother seemed to be pregnant and everyone knew she'd separated from her husband. So again, the most sordid of stories, here's a woman who's not with a husband and she's pregnant. So it was very clear to everyone that the child that would be born from this pregnancy would be a child who is blemished in the worst possible way. And of course, that's why they rejected him. They rejected him. Yishai's sons were living at home, and David was banished to the hills. He was sent out to be a shepherd with the sheep because they couldn't bear to have him around. He's such a blemished and sordid and soiled spiritual being. And of course, what happens is Yishai was a man of supernal greatness. The Gemara says that when he gave a shir, 100,000 people, I'm very honored that you came to hear me, you know, but when he gave a shir, 100,000 people used to come and listen. The Gemara says he was one of four people who never sinned ever. Yishai. His name implies spiritual perfection. Yesh, yesh, yesh is always the number of the world to come, really. 310 worlds that every tzaddik has. And he is a man of spiritual greatness, and his sons were absolute stars. I mean, everyone thought really that knowing they were descended from the house of from Beis Yehuda, that the oldest son would be the king. And in fact, he was slated, as it were, to be king. And the Chazal say the only reason he wasn't king was because he made one mistake in his life. was so close to perfection. The only mistake he made in his life was he said once an angry word. He said an angry word when David came to the front and he was there facing this giant of a tank of a man, Goliath, right, Goliath. And no one could bear to face him. He was invincible. And when David said, well, you know, let me try. No. And his older brother spoke angrily to him. He disqualified himself from eligibility to be the king. And of course, when Shmuel got the nevuah that he should go to the Beis Yishai to anoint the next king, so Shmuel went down to, and it made perfect sense, who better than Yishai, right? Correctly descended and one of the greatest men who ever lived, spiritually unblemished. And Shmuel was confident that it would be the oldest son of Yishai, and he must have been an unbelievable and superb. So you can imagine the effort that went into him and from his great father. And Shmuel walked into the house and he said to Yishai, you know, I have a nevuah that I have to come and anoint a king from your sons. And the oldest son arrived, and as Shmuel stepped forward to anoint him the next king of Israel, a voice inside him said, he's not the one. So then he said, well, let's see the next son. And they brought the next son in, and when they'd gone through all of them, and none of them answered the prophetic instruction, they looked at each other, you know, Yishai and Shmuel, and Shmuel said, you know, Hashem told me clearly that's one of your sons, and we've been through all of them. So they all looked around at each other, and they said, well, you don't mean David, do you? I mean, you know, he's illegitimate. I mean, he's banished. He's lower than... So Shmuel said, bring him in. And when David was brought in from the hills as this reject, that prophetic voice in him said, he's the one. So, yes, what turned out to be, in other words, what ostensibly was the most seamy and sordid and squalid of human products was unknown to them. He'd been perfecting himself on those lonely Judean hillsides, meditating and becoming close to Hashem. But ostensibly to the outside world, he was a complete, worse than a reject. And that is the story of Mashiach. Again and again, the seed that falls into the earth and, as it were, is rejected and detached from life and rots, has no life of his own, has no spirituality apparently, and deep hidden within is the source of life, and that seed begins to sprout. That's some of the story behind the name of Tzemach, which is the theme of David. Kumu kfushe afar, arise you who are bound or bonded in the dirt. Hakitsuranu v'shechna, rejoice, get up and rejoice. Rabasi ambam lichoi, in the multitude of the people who crown him. Migdal Yeshua smalkoi, this is the enlarging or the, I don't know, Migdal. Yeshua is the greatness of the salvation of this king. Shem Rishayim lahavid, etc., etc. And this is the announcement of David. Now, there's so many things to understand here. Why David? Why Hoshana Rabbah? Why the Hoshana? Why the seventh? Why Sukkos? Let's see what we can manage to... What can we manage to... Which threads can we pull together here? First of all, you know the Hoshana, the Arava, is the lowest of the species, right? It also is that which has nothing. Of all the four species, it's the one that has no content of its own. You know, all the other three, each one has its quality. The Esrog has a full house, it has smell and taste, and the Lulav has one of those, and the Hadassim have another. But the Lulav has taste, the dates, and the Hadassim have the smell, beautiful smell. The Arava has nothing, right? It is that it's almost impossible to possel an Arava. All you need is two leaves. It's almost nothing. It has nothing of its own. It has almost no halachic requirements compared to the others. It's almost impossible to invalidate. It is the lowest of the... It's the lowest of the species, and it's shaped like lips, right? It's shaped like lips, and the mitzvah of the day of Hoshana is tefillah. No accident that David HaMelech says about himself, "Va'ani tefillah." He calls himself tefillah, not that he's the one who prays. He defines himself as tefillah. He is the one who prays, and that needs analysis. What is the meaning of the mitzvah of tefillah? Why is it Shaita Hoshana Rabbah more than anything else? We have plenty of extra tefillahs on Hoshana Rabbah. In fact, that's all the day has, as Vasemir says. That's all you can really do is call out when you have nothing else. All you can do is call out in appeal, as it were. And I heard from Rabbi Ziskin once, many years ago, that the whole meaning of tefillah is a exploration of self. Right? The word Tefillah means, it's a word that implies judgment. There's a judgment of self. And as I'm sure you're aware, the word for prayer in Hebrew can only be said in the reflexive. It's an amazing thing. The verb for prayer in Hebrew, it can only be expressed in the reflexive. And by the way, for those who have any Kabbalistic knowledge here, and I'm sure you're all black belts Kabbalistically, you'll know that of the seven forms of the verb in Hebrew, you know the Hebrew verb has seven forms. Seventh of them is the reflexive. The first is called kal, that's the simple meaning of the verb, and you run through seven forms of the verb. The last form of the verb in Hebrew is called hitpael. That's where the thing does the thing to itself. Right? To dress in Hebrew is lavash, lovesh. To dress yourself, to get dressed, is lehit labesh, where you do the thing to yourself. The only way you can say to pray in Hebrew is lehit palel, which means to be judging the self somehow. What does that mean? That's what I was just going to say. The real meaning of judging the self here is to find the self empty. But that means there's a self-analysis and a self-judgment which delves so deeply that you expose your own emptiness. And that's the Arava which is completely empty. Let's try to work through some of this and see where it leaves us. I mean, it should leave us empty, right? That you should walk out of here this evening, if we succeeded. This evening you should walk out here completely empty. So those are some of the correlates. There are many others, of course. Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, another way to look at this is that Hashem showed him the storehouses of treasure for each mitzvah. Hashem, the Medrash says, Hashem showed Moshe Rabbeinu the amazing storehouses of reward. And Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, who's this for? And Hashem, this is for those who raise orphans. That's this enormous treasure house. And who's this one for? People who do other mitzvahs. And then he came to the biggest of all of them. And Moshe Rabbeinu said to Hashem, and who's this reward for? And Hashem said, those who have nothing at all. Nothing at all. Completely empty. Don't take this lightly. It's a big work. It's a big achievement to be empty. If you think you're nothing already, you're badly mistaken. To be empty, to be truly humble, you have to be a somebody. Right? Somebody who's nobody and says he's nobody is not humble, he's just right. Right? A person who's humble is a person who's a somebody and says he's a nobody. If you're a nobody and you walk around saying you're nobody, you're just accurate, that's all. You're not, that's not called humble. Humble is, Moshe Rabbeinu was humble. He was the greatest of human beings and said that he was nothing, right? So the theme of the day is really achieving emptiness. That's the theme. So let's try to work through this and understand what is the quality of emptiness. Perhaps the way to begin is to start with the middah of Malchus. You know, David HaMelech is the seventh of these persona who come to the world, and the seventh of any series in our deeper teaching is called Malchus. Malchus means the principle of kingship. English words don't really mean much, but Malchus really means the function of being a king. But being a king in the sense of uniting the people and being nothing other than the agent that unites them. The concept of Malchus is the concept of the thing that reveals everything else without revealing itself. It's only the agent that makes everything else visible. Right? You know that the way the Zohar puts it, and you can never put it better than that, the Zohar says that Malchus is the middah that's called Leis Leimi Gar Me Klum. He has nothing of his own. He has nothing of his own. That means all his content is demonstrating what everything else is. If you wanted a very, very crude analogy, I would say that Malchus is like the computer screen. The point of the screen is not to show you the screen. If it does, it's a bad screen. The point of the screen is to show you what it's meant to project. Is this clear? If you end up looking at the screen and you see the screen, that's not a good screen. Something that is, if you're a computer buff, you call it a GUI. You know what a GUI is? A graphic user interface. Well, a good GUI is something that doesn't show itself to you, it shows the thing. Right? It shows the whatever the program is or whatever the computer is trying to show you, you don't want to see it. As soon as you put something in of the thing that's demonstrating the thing, then you foul up the program. Let's try to understand this. I mean, there's so many ways to approach it. Here's one. The Gemara says that Rabbi Shimon ben Hananya once was talking to the Caesar's daughter. Right? Shimon ben Hananya talking back in the days of the Tanoim, the beginning of the Roman Empire. Rabbi Shimon ben Hananya, his outstanding quality was unspeakable ugliness. Right? He was ugly to the point of being misshapen. And once when he met, in fact, he was so ugly that she wasn't even embarrassed to say to him, Yeah, how could you be so? So when she met him, she said to him, how could there be such wonderful wisdom in such a broken, in such a ugly vessel? How can there be such wonderful wisdom in a vessel that is so damaged? It's an amazing question. First of all, you realize this is a question coming from a woman who is the source and vessel of beauty. She is there for beauty. And it comes from a Roman woman. Rome is nothing other than Greece. Rome has no culture of its own, right? The Romans only propagated and foisted a Greek wisdom on the world. And Greece is nothing other than a beautiful mind and a beautiful body. Right? That's Greece. The Olympic Games were played naked. The point is to show, right, what they call mens sana in corpore. You speak Latin? Mens sana in corpore sana. A healthy mind in a healthy body. Right? A beautiful mind in a healthy body. The two go hand in hand. You need a beautiful vessel to demonstrate a beautiful... That is Greece. Yephes was that purpose, right? The purpose of Greece. They weren't mistaken in that. Was to hold beautiful content in a beautiful vessel. And ultimately, that will be right. That will be brought in. Right? That will be brought into our... That beauty and that aspect of Yephes is meant to be brought into Torah. It will be one day. So she said to him, this is a woman and a Roman woman. She says, how can you have the two? How can such incredible wisdom in such an ugly body? So Yeshua ben Hanani said to her, what does your father keep his wine in? King, Caesar. She said, in clay vessels like everyone else. You know, they used what are called amphora. These clay or ceramic earthenware vessels. He said to her, but that's not fitting for a king. Surely a king should have his wine in gold and silver. So she went back to the palace and she ordered all her father's wine put into gold vessels. Now when you put alcohol into metal, it goes off. The alcohol leaches out the metal and it ruins. So when they served wine at the Caesar's table, whether this was Caesar himself or the governor of Eretz Yisrael, whoever it was, so he said, what's going on? So she said, the Jew told me to do it. So he had him called in and he said, what are you doing? What did you do? So he said to the Caesar, I only told your daughter what she said to me. I showed her that when the vessel adds its own content, it spoils it. When the vessel adds its own chashivas, its own importance, a vessel has to be only a vessel. The reason I have my wisdom is because I'm ugly. The reason I have my wisdom, if I would have had beauty, something external, they would have ruined the content. But she was a bright girl, and she wasn't satisfied. She didn't take that lying down. So she said to him, what about your friends who are so good looking, and they're so wise? You know, the Gemara says later in the generation of Rabbi Yochanan, for example, Rabbi Yochanan was so incredibly beautiful, so unbelievably beautiful. He used to sit outside the mikveh. So women going home to their husbands would see something, but you know, Alpi Kabbalah, a woman should see something only very beautiful. She should, or at least something human, not very bad if she sees many, many stories of women come from the mikveh, saw an animal, they'd go back and tevel again, come out and see many stories like that. So they used to put him outside the mikveh that women should see his form. The Gemara says he once went to visit one of his friends who was ill and poverty-stricken in a dark house. Rabbi Yochanan lifted his sleeve and lit the house. His beauty was so incandescent that by rolling up his sleeve, he lit the house. Right? And there were Tanoim like that, you know, that Caesar's daughter craved. We learned in the Asura. So she said to him, listen, your story doesn't wash because you have friends and colleagues who are unbelievably wise and unbelievably beautiful. So he said to her, have a sunny, have a gemiri tfei. Had they been ugly, they would have been wiser. In other words, they managed that great wisdom despite their good looks. But it's a hindrance, I assure you. And the whole meaning of this, really, is that when the vessel adds its own material, then it ruins the content. If you're going to be a vessel, be only a vessel. Right? And the real beauty of a vessel, in as much as it's only a vessel, yeah, that's its purpose. By the way, tefillah, you understand? Tefillah is being a vessel. This constant theme. Tefillah is being a vessel. So let's understand this. First of all, that's the middah of Malchus. Leis lemi garmei klum. He has nothing of his own. Don't make a mistake. Doesn't mean he has nothing of his own in the simple sense. The king who has nothing of his own means he has everything. He's the most powerful, aggrandized, amazingly. Who will the Mashiach be? David will come as Mashiach. The Mashiach will be the most incontrovertibly categorically great leader who ever lived in the world. Who is Mashiach? Mashiach will be a king greater than the world has dreamed of before. Be international ruler with no fear of contradiction. Has ever been a king like a Nimrod ruled the whole world? But Avram Avinu didn't agree. First of all, Shem and Ava weren't his subjects. At least they didn't pay homage. And Avram Avinu stood on the one side and defied him, but thrown into fire, survived, and ultimately won. So which king had they been? Nebuchadnezzar? Who? never been a king that ultimately didn't fall. The Mashiach will be that king. He'll be the dream of all kings. He'll be a king so powerful, so almighty. Something like, if you wonder, a slight hint of what it was, like in the days of King Solomon. When kings and queens from all over the world paid him homage, right? And the queens of the world insisted on marrying him. And the world was peaceful. They were all under his dominion. This will be an everlasting, eternal. And that human being who reaches that pinnacle of power will demonstrate that he's nothing. That's humility. The point is to be that great and then demonstrate that you're nothing. The Rambam says the function of a king is la'ached umasenu. His purpose is to unite the people. He's the focus that unites the people, the Jewish people, and in fact in his generation the world, and he brings them into contact with Hashem. You know, one of the problems with Mashiach, one of the questions about Mashiach, is why we need him in the first place. Why do you need Mashiach? We began to speak about this morning, some of us. Why do you need Mashiach? Mashiach is that person who will come to the world in that phase of history when you would think that he's not needed. If anyone asked me, if I'd been asked to design human history, and I mean no one has asked me, but if anyone had designed me, I would have said we need Mashiach now. We need him in the worst phases of history. Who needs him when Hashem is openly revealed? When Hashem appears on earth, right? Kamayim liyam chasim, it dies. Mala'ad's dea, that means the world will be filled with das, knowledge of Hashem openly. Das doesn't mean knowledge, it means intimate connection. That means you'll be bonded with Hashem in a clear experience. Who needs Mashiach then? The worst thing in Jewish thinking is intermediaries, something between us and Hashem, right? We're totally allergic to that. We
didn't Moshe represent that in some way?
Yes, of course. Moshe, he was a king.
Moshe and David are two different.
It's part of the same line. Moshe was the king in that generation. He was the greatest human being and the most humble. That's why Zerch to bring Torah. He was Ma'achet Kul Ma'asem. When Moshe Rabbeinu stood there, the Torah speaks, switches into singular. Ki Ishechad B'Lev Echad. How did that happen? Moshe Rabbeinu was the Moked. He was the source and center around his Shakul Keneged everybody, and he unites everybody. We all become one, and he's there at that time.
But nonetheless, the Shpiz in David is different than
Moshe. Yes, that means. This theme runs through all, of course. It begins with Avraham Avinu, who also makes himself known. I don't understand this. But it comes to fulfillment, that aspect of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? And in fact, that aspect, stay tuned, we'll try to, this is a recurring theme, obviously, it's the beginning and the end. But the reason we have Mashiach is because when Hashem reveals himself openly, human beings also be revealing themselves perfectly. What will be Yemosa Mashiach? Hashem will reveal himself openly, to whom? To a people who have reached their perfection. Which means that Hashem will reveal himself clearly as he is meant to be, seen and appreciated, and we will be revealing ourselves as what? People who have united in perfection around a central focus that unites us all, who's the greatest human being and brings all of humanity under his wing and unites them and demonstrates that we're nothing. Only a vessel that holds Hashem's presence. Right? By the way, this is the secret of Sukkos, which is Beis HaShoeva. Why is it called Beis? Simcha's Beis HaShoeva. What's the Beis doing there? What's important to have a Beis? You know, according to some girsos, it's not even Beis HaShoeva, it's Beis HaChashuva. There's two girsos. Beis HaChashuva. What does that mean? A place of importance. House. The idea of a Beis is a woman. The idea of Beis is an empty space where things happen. She makes that possible. Why does she walk around the groom? Why does she walk around the husband? To Sevev Gever, she walks around. It's his chuppah. He brings her in. But she says to him, I give you the place to be. Right? She is the empty vessel, as it were, that is fulfilling, as it were, Isha Kshera Eser Etzoin Baila. A kosher woman is doing her husband's desire. She brings his rotzen into expression in the world. So Mashiach will be that persona that unites us in revealing who we are, and what we're supposed to be is emptiness. Let's see some of the manifestations of that. What is tefillah? What is tefillah? Tefillah is being a woman. If you want to look this up, I looked for it now, but we couldn't find the copy. There's a very nice book called Rikshei Lev by Manny Nissel. That book is a book on the laws and customs and deeper understanding of tefillah for women, prayer for women, right? He wrote a book on, it's called Rikshei Lev. The book is great and you should read it, but it's certainly worth it, if for nothing else, than Rav Moshe Shapiro's introduction. He writes one page and he says there, the most beautiful and penetrating idea. This is a book dealing with tefillah for women. Get this book for your wife. Right? And you read the introduction. He says there that tefillah, the correct way to stand in front of Hashem, is like a woman. That means when fulfilling the mitzvah of tefillah, we should all be that woman who's craving closeness to her husband. The Gemara says there are four chukois. There are four desires in the world. One of them is a woman's desire for her husband. What does that mean? Let's get this, too much to speak about in one night, but let's try to get it clear. You know that the Rambam famously, or rather made famous by Reb Chaim, points out that the mitzvah of tefillah has two kavanas. The Rambam contradicts himself. The Rambam says in one place that what should be your intention for prayer when you daven? What should the kavana be? So in one place, or what's the minimum kavana? So Rambam says in one place, you have to have intention for the meaning of the words. You have to mean what the words say. Another place, the Rambam says, and there he says that if you don't mean all the words, you can get away with less than focusing and concentrating on all the words. Famously, he says that in all the 19 blessings of Shmon Esrei, if you only mean the first one, you are Yotze, and then he goes on to say, very humiliating, extremely humiliating, that if you fail to have intention, even for the first one, don't go back because you'll get it wrong again, basically. But it seems you can get away with, the minimum requirement is that you need to have intention for the simple meaning of the words. And there, if you don't have simple, some of that's missing, you could still possibly, there's a minimum shear that would fulfill the requirement. Elsewhere, the Rambam says, if you don't have intention for in tefillah, it's completely invalid. You haven't prayed at all. You haven't done it at all. It's a famous Reb Chaim, one of the classic pieces, in which he shows that these two sections, and there I'm talking about two completely different types of kavanah. The first, the Rambam, the one of them, the Rambam is talking about the kavanah of the meaning of the words. And that, if you're not perfect and you don't mean every single word, there's what to talk about. The second kavanah the Rambam is talking about is the kavanah of standing lifnei Hashem. That means that the idea of prayer is you're standing in front of Hashem. If you're missing that, you haven't prayed. And that from that is derived this very famous principle in Reb Chaim Brisk, that if you are missing words or kavanah in words, that's a halachic issue. It has its shear, it has its measure. But if you forget that you're standing in front of Hashem, right, then you haven't davened at all. In other words, the basic issue in tefillah is not what you're saying and what you're asking for. The basic inyan in tefillah is amida bifnei HaMelech, standing there in front of Hashem. Right? What for? To make yourself a vessel, you want his relationship with you. You know, Rosh Shapiro put it this way. It says, Arba chukai sein, there are four cravings. A chukka means a longing. Right? More than a rotzon, more than a desire, a longing. The four longings in the world. One is Yetzer Hara, we don't have time to discuss them all. Yetzer Hara l'kain, the evil inclination for kain. One of them is Hashem for us, that means the Jewish people's closeness for Hashem. One is...
What's the meaning of the first one?
Yetzer Hara l'kain. The Yetzer Hara craves that agent which is kain and hevel. One of them is the closeness to Hashem and us. One of them is Eretz Lageshem. Did I say four?
Three.
What's the fourth?
Isha
Labaila. So the fourth one is Isha Labaila. That is a woman's desire for her husband. So Ramosha points out very, very beautifully, very sensitively, what is a woman's desire for her husband? There are two ways you can desire a relationship with somebody. You want somebody to give you something, be it an object or be it the relationship. There are two opposite ways you can want it. One is because you have a need. You want the person to fulfill your need. The other is because you want the person to fulfill. You want them to fulfill your need. Again, a world of difference. You can want somebody to give you something, right? A child can want his father to give him something for two reasons. One, he wants the thing. The father happens to be the way that he's going to get it. Second, he doesn't want the thing. He wants his father to give him something. The object happens to be the way he's going to get giving from his father. Again, in a real love relationship, the husband is going to give his wife something, his closeness, or provide for her, whatever it is. An immature love is where she wants him to give what he's going to give because she needs the thing. He happens to be the agent that's going to service that need. A mature love is she wants him to give that because that is his closeness to her. The object, irrelevant.
What's the giving?
It's the closeness. It's the fact that your attitude in tefillah is, Hashem, my needs here are irrelevant. the pleasure I will have in having my needs fulfilled is the fact that you've given them to me. That means if you offered me these from some other source, I don't want them from there. Again, immature desire is, Hashem, I don't really care if it's you or the bank manager. Well, these days you can't. Nobody could. No one could get confused there. But like, imagine you have a bank manager who's like old style, you know. So the person who wants the money, who cares whether it comes from Hashem? I'm quite happy from the bank manager. No. A woman isn't wanting what the husband gives. She doesn't want the 12 red roses. She wants the husband to give the 12 red roses. Again, to make this very clear, how would she feel on Friday afternoon if a postman knocked on the door and said, you've been selected by our computer, right, to receive the most beautiful, expensive 12 red roses. Congratulations. Here you are. How would you feel? I would think so. Yeah, but what can you do with roses? You can't eat them. What are you going to do with them? But when the husband brings the roses, the ikkah is not the roses. It's the husband. This dull, dense, obtuse, forgetful husband thought about me out there. He remembered. And therefore, the tshuka of Isha Labayla is not that she wants her needs serviced. What she needs, what she wants is the husband to service those needs. The husband's... So Moshe put it very beautifully. Note that it says Eretz Legeshem. It doesn't say Eretz Lamayim. The difference is this. Eretz Legeshem. Eretz Lamayim means the earth wants water. Who cares where it comes from? Uh-uh. It wants Geshem. It wants Hashem's water, the rain. It wants it to come from there. It's a beautiful diuk. It should have said Eretz Lamayim. Who cares where it comes from? No, it doesn't want Mayim. It wants Geshem. Geshem is Min HaShamayim. That's where it wants it from. And therefore, he says, Tefillah is standing in front of Hashem and saying, Hashem, the needs are irrelevant. The way I will feel your closeness. Right? Of course I want my needs and I need those things, of course. But the essence of Tefillah is, Hashem, I want it to come from your hand. Now, that will be the real pleasure and the real ecstasy in this thing will be. And therefore, I declare myself empty, not because I want you to fulfill the needs, but because I want you to fulfill the needs. Right? And therefore, Tefillah is essentially a carving out of an empty space. You see this in another way as well. Tefillah is, what is the definition of Tefillah? The basic concept of Tefillah is Amida Bifnei HaMelech, Bifnei Hashem. But what is the mode of Tefillah? It's asking. Again, how are Tefillahs constituted? We ask Hashem. Right? There's many interesting questions here. How can you ask Hashem for your needs and call that Avoida? Avoida Hashem, right? It's called Avoida Shebelev. Tefillah is Avoda Shebelev. It means the work of the heart. Avoda means korbanos, sacrifices. Right? In fact, the laws of Tefillah are learned from sacrifices. Sacrifices isn't give me. Sacrifices is I give you. It's a wrong mode completely. Again, how can we have the chutzpah to say we are manifesting here korbanos, right? We are learning, we're manifesting here the theme of sacrifices. What's a sacrifice? You come to Beis HaMikdash, say, Hashem, this is my life. Rav Nefesh HaChaim says, and many others say, that when you give an animal to Hashem, it's like your life here. It's the animal side of your... You're giving your life to Hashem. That's what it is. Not what he's going to give to you. Right? As a famous Jewish authority once said, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country, right? Therefore, you come and you say to Hashem, what can I give you? Here's my life. So now we emulate that in Tefillah. Hashem, here I am, and I want health, wealth, wisdom. What you can give me? And then you call it Avoida? What's going on? You express your needs and desires, and you call that service of Hashem. The correct mode should be, Hashem, I'm here for you. You tell me what you want. I'll go through anything for you. Instead, you stand there asking Him what you want, and you call that Tefillah? But the secret is this, and it's very clear in Nefesh HaChaim when he talks about Tefillah. What you're doing is sublimating your own ritzonos. Like this. The essence of who you are is what you want. That's the root of who you are. Again, anything you manifest in the world always goes back to a ritzon. I give you a gift in the world. The object is a physical object. The hand and the muscles all meet. Animal. The nerves, the brain impulses. The only thing that's human about me is the original spark of volition that I want, I will. My desire, the word ratzon in Hebrew, which according to Kabbalistic sources is here. Here, where a baby's head is open. Right? Where there was once an open connection. By the way, this is where you wear tefillin, which is Lashon Tefillah. I mean, it's the same Rashi says you have to wear your tefillin when the baby's head is open. In Kabbalah it's written that Adam HaRishon had tefillin growing out of his head. We have a hole there now because you no longer have them. Tefillin is putting, it's called Bekiya Samachin in Kabbalah. Tefillin is where the brain bursts out or the light breaks in. What is tefillin? Tefillin is a reconstituting the, it's the keser, it's the crown that Adam HaRishon had, which was the ikkah. The Rambam says that a person who doesn't fulfill mitzvahs, certain consequences. He doesn't fulfill mitzvahs tefillin, he's not alive. The Rambam says, Hilchos Tshuva, the only mitzvah that he singles out, that detaches you from the spiritual world in a certain kind of a way, is tefillin. Why? Because tefillin is a reconnection with that higher world, and it's no accident that it's called tefillah. This place where the baby's head is open, the fontanelle, right, which is exactly where you have to wear your tefillin, that place is called, in the deeper Svarim, that's called the place of Ratzon. Ratzon. Ratzon means the originating desire that leads to any expression in the world. The word Ratzon in Hebrew has the same gematria as the word Makor, which means the source. Actually, Shmoy, Hashem's name, has the same gematria. Ultimate source. Meaning that, and you know, a source is a very mysterious thing. You can't ask for the source of a source. That's incoherent. The furthest back you can ever go is an original source. You can't ask why or go back. The deepest you can ever go. By the way, this is why whenever we say, why is such and such a thing in the world? We say, it's a Ratzon Hashem. All those ultimate questions. Why is the world as big as it is? Could have been bigger, could have been smaller. It's a Ratzon Hashem. People think you're fobbing off the question. You're answering the question. That's why. You can't ask why is Hashem's Ratzon the way it is. You can't ask why Ratzon is. Is this clear? If it's the ultimate source, then it is because it is. Of course, this is where free will is. That's why free will choice cannot be explained by something prior. That wouldn't be free. So when you want to know who you really are, it's what you want. This is a very humiliating exercise, but everyone has to do it. Shana Rav is a very good time to do it. Go into a room by yourself, close the door, breathe deeply, meditate, close your eyes, calm yourself down and ask yourself, what do I really want? What do I really want? At the deepest possible level. What pops into your mind is usually not that complimentary. Not that complimentary. Most people, if they're honest, will come up with the conclusion what they really want is to curl up and lie down in the sun and go to sleep like a dog. And that's already advanced, you know, there's worse. Okay, now you say to yourself, what do I really want? That. Okay, now why do I want that? Ooh, if I had that, I could do. Why do you want that thing? Wait, if I had that, I could do. Why do you want that? Sooner or later, and it's usually sooner, you'll get to something that you want for no other reason than the fact that you want it. That's you. Out of that deep rotzen, which has no explanation because it is the source, all the rest flow. And as a result, Rabbi Shmuel Salanter famously points out, you can't judge from external activity what that inner rotzen is. Where he used to call it the zrizus von a soldat, you know, the zrizus of a soldier. You see a soldier, typically, I've been in the army, I can tell you, see a soldier's rushing around like crazy to get the job done. Why? Because he's very active and alert and energetic? No. So he can get it done faster, so he can sleep more. You can't judge from the externality what the inner motivation, but the inner motivation, the genuine inner motivation, and here's the secret, if you want to change who you are, you have to change what you want. If you simply change your external style, that's not a genuine change. So last week, you were able to run after this childish desire that you had. You ran after it. This week, you walk after it in a refined way. Yeah, that's an advance, but a very small advance. Because the inner childish desire is still the same. If you want to change who you really are, you have to change what you want. This is what it means in Pirkei Avos. Aseh ritzoncha ritzono. Make his desire yours. Nullify yours. Make it his. So it's like this. Here's the question. If you want to change who you are, you have to change your rotzen. How do you change a desire? You can't change a root. What do you say? Hashem, what I really want to do is curl up in the sun and go to sleep. Now I stand there and say, Hashem, what I really want to do be as a servant of yours. You're lying through your teeth. This is that you want to be a slave to Hashem. You don't. But the truth is you'd rather he was yours. You say, Hashem, I want to be your slave. You're lying. So how do you get to the point where you really want it? You can't say it. How do you change? You can't pull yourself up by your own root. The answer is you can't. You can't formulate a new rotzen. But you can sacrifice the one you have. That's the korban of tefillah. You can say, Hashem, the root of who I am is this thing. You know what? Take it. Take it. And if you give it up, you get a new one. It's a gift. Comes from another place. You want a moshel for this, I would say, that if you concentrate, it's like a very crude moshel. Let's say you need the solution to a problem. You don't have the answer to your problem. You search for the answer. What do? You walk around for hours, you pace back and forwards, and suddenly it hits you. Right? How do you do that? You can't concentrate on the answer to your problem. You don't have the answer. Concentration is not thinking about the solution to your problem. Concentration is keeping the noise out of the way long enough so that it falls in. Ask an architect. Or anybody has to come up with a creative solution. You don't think of the solution. You open yourself up until it falls. This is why in Yiddish an idea is called an Einfall. It falls in. And then you have the big deal of chutzpah to say, I worked it out. You don't work it out. Usually it happens when you go to sleep. You wake up the next morning, you say, I've got it. And you say, I worked it out. You don't work it out. You went to sleep. Concentration isn't thinking about the solution. Concentration is keeping the static out of the way long enough. And in personality building, Rav Simcha Wasserman said it's the same thing. How do you become a bigger person? By keeping yourself out of the way long enough that he gives you, you know what he used to say? The world is full of light except where we cast the shadows. You try and be such a big deal shining the light, you're getting in the way. If you move out of the way, Moshe Rabbeinu was the greatest human being who ever lived because he was the emptiest. Then he became personally the greatest, didn't disappear. Because you did the work of making yourself the vessel, and that's all you can do. And this is the secret of an amazing, amazing thing. This is an endless discussion, but I'll say this. That's all you can really do. Listen well to this. When you open yourself up like that, you keep the distractions out of the way long enough that it hits you like a bombshell and it pounds into your consciousness and you lift it to that ecstatic experience. At that moment you realize that you successfully did that. You disappeared. You disappeared and you became part of Kiviyochu. At that moment, you became one. That means his presence and yours. Asei Ritzoncha Ritzoneh. That means his Ritzon became yours. At that moment, you expanded your consciousness to the root. This has many manifestations, but yes, spoke through his throat, absolutely. All he did was become a vessel. The paradox is, to empty yourself in that way is the most personally ecstatic thing you can do. The most personal development is in that particular dimension. Of course, it doesn't mean anything to you in terms of ego. So that is the, right, that's the, here's the secret, amazing, amazing question. It's an amazing question. If this doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. The Ramchal says many times in Derech Hashem and in Das Tfunis, in many places, that the whole point of having work in the world, right, is so that the gift you get given is not a humiliation, right? That's called the Namarik Sufa. He quotes, it's a Tosis quotes, Yerushalmi, that the reason that Hashem gives you work in the world is because if he gave you your final perfection and pleasure and ecstasy in Olam Haba for free, then you'd feel the humiliation of a free handout, right? The Lashon of the Yerushalmi is, man de'achil deloy delay, a person who eats from something that is not of his, gets it from someone else, is he has shame to look in the face of the person, right? He has humiliation when he looks in the face of the person who gave him a free handout. To avoid you feeling the humiliation of Hashem giving it to you for free, Hashem says, do it yourself. So you have the pleasure and the dignity of earning it for yourself. I'm not going to deal tonight with why Hashem had set it up that way in the first place. He could have made you somebody who loves getting gifts. Interesting question. Wonderful subject, not for tonight. But here's the question. Listen carefully. Namadik Sufa, the bread of shame, is generated when you get given something you didn't deserve, you didn't earn. Therefore, you have to earn your chelik in Olam Haba so that you feel not shame, but genuine pleasure. Here's the problem. All our sources say that the ecstasy you have in Olam Haba is infinitely greater than the work you could possibly have done. So how did you solve the problem? The language of the Baal HaLashem Zal is HaTosefes Meruba Minayika. That means you did work. How much work could you have done? How much work did you do? 120 years of backbreaking, enormous, amazing work? That's nothing compared to what Hashem is going to give you in Olam Haba. He's going to... But again, you've done... How much work can you do on yourself in a lifetime? Whatever you'll answer, the reward you're going to get is infinite! So aren't you going to feel shame? again. The challenge is, when you're given something you didn't work for, you feel shame. You're going to get given, the language is Tosefos, Ikka, is Merubah. No, Ikka, the Tosefos is vastly more. Vastly, an eternity of pleasure. And you put in 120 years. So I feel shame. Again, it's an amazing question, this. I don't see any moved faces. It's an amazing kasha.
If you've got a close up to it,
yeah.
Then you don't have the embarrassment because it's not yours.
But the problem is you're going to feel embarrassed if you get giving something you didn't work for. Now you are enjoying an eternity of ecstasy. Because one drop of any penny you get given for free generates humiliation. Beseda. So now you feel amazing for the 120 years worth of ecstasy. And the next 5 billion, trillion, zillion, quadrillion.
It's quadrillion if you did your best.
But it's more than you did.
But you couldn't do more.
But the problem is there's humiliation in being given something you didn't earn.
You earned it if you did the best you could.
But it's more than you could have done.
So you won the raffle, but at least you bought the ticket.
But that's not... You have to appreciate the problem. The direction of solution to this problem, we don't have time to go into it fully now. The direction is, your work is to become a vessel. Your work is to empty yourself to become a receiver. That's the job. That's the job. You weren't given the task of generating the reward. You can't begin to do that. Your task is to become a vessel for it. To the extent that you empty yourself out and become a vessel, that's... Your job isn't to generate the reward. Your job is...
You created a very small vessel and then you can...
Can create an infinite vessel if you can empty yourself completely to nothing. And that's the message. This goes on in many, many ways. But if you did, you should feel that.
No, you didn't.
Which ecstasy are you talking about? The blast of the idea that hits you? Or the pride that this is your work?
The ultimate pleasure of feeling yourself doing this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doing what? Let's say you... One second. Let's say you spent a week or doing some amazing thing and you see the result. That's a genuine pleasure. You did that.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the pleasure of getting an idea? Which pleasure are you talking about?
Yeah.
But tefillah is changing your rotzen. Let me just complete that, by the way. You know that... How can we prove that tefillah is changing your rotzen? Because Hashem davens. Hashem davens, right? The Gemara in Brochas, Dav Zayin. Vav Zayin. Yes. So what's Hashem's Lashon? What's Hashem's Lashon of Tefillah? No, the first one says Hashem Davens. He does all our mitzvahs. What's the Lashon of his Tefillah? Yirotzon milfanai, she'akom mikisei adin, ve'eshev kisera. May it be my will. Our Tefillah is, Yirotzon milfanecho, may it be your will. Hashem's Tefillah, may it be my will. His Tefillah is nothing other than intrinsic, internal change of Rotzon. Yirotzon, that I should change from Kisei Adin to Kisei Rachamim. You see, the definition of tefillah isn't asking somebody, is Hashem going to ask? Hashem davens. Who's going to ask? What's he going to ask for? You see, the definition of tefillah is an intrinsic change in Ratzon. So Hashem's tefillah is, may I arise from this mode and move into that mode. Have a Omer, that the mitzvah of tefillah is changing your Ratzon. And the Nefesh HaChaim says what it is. He says the change in Ratzon is, Hashem up to now wanted £100,000 for me. Now I want £100,000 to use for you. I want the thing. And I don't... Nefesh HaChaim says the essence of change of Ratzon is not that you no longer want it. By the way, that's an Eastern idea. In an Eastern mode, you should no longer want it. In our mode, you should want it more powerfully than before, but for the right reason.
As a means.
The person who comes to his master and says, Master, I'm your slave. Do whatever you want with me. Push me, pull me. He's just a nuisance, not a slave. A real slave is a person who comes to his master and he says, Master, I'm burning with ambition. I'm burning with ambition. I want to be the greatest I can be. For you, not for me. That's a slave. A person who's great spiritually comes to Hashem. Isn't it? I'm nothing. I'm amazing. He hasn't killed his personality and his sense of humor and his ambition. He's killed the egotistical frazich. That means... And therefore, David is a person who comes to Hashem and he says, Hashem... And when he asks for a test and he's saying... What's David's midah? David, as the forerunner of Mashiach, his midah is total ego emptiness. You know that David means that. Dalad, vav, dalad. Medaktikim say dalad means emptiness. Dalus, empty. Vav, hoysofa, given everything. And he remains the same simple dalad. By the way, Sukkos is the battle between David and Gog. Gog u'magog. Shav Hirsch has his famous shirt in what Gog means. But in the line of this, it is David is dalad, vav, dalad. Emptiness, dalus, having nothing. Vav, Hashem gives him everything. And he remains the same simple dalad. Gog, gimel, vav, gimel. Gimel means he is overflowing with his own self-importance. Vav, Hashem gives him everything. And he remains the same self-inflated, self-important gimel that he was. There's a polarity. David is the one who empties himself, should be emptying himself completely, fights against Gog, who is full of himself. That's the battle of Sukkos. All the Balei Musa say. The problem is, Adam Arishan also wanted what he wanted, only for Hashem. But there was the millionth of a zillionth of a trillionth.
Adam Arishan, of course, Bog said, down.
When Adam Arishan said to Hashem, I want to serve you, the only mistake he made was in saying, I want to serve you. He made one error. Instead of saying, I want to serve you, he said, I want to serve you. That's all. That's all. When David said to Hashem, B'chaneni na'avan haseini, as Rabbi Dessler explains, Rabbi Miller explains, what middah are you controverting when you ask for a test? Ask me, I'll test me, I'll show you. No one asks for a test that he's going to fail. Test me, I'll show you! But to be tested, to put yourself into the firing line where you have to show your greatness. And that's why the Mefarshim say that he did this after he asked for the test and realized he had to fail deliberately. Lahoras tshuva leyachid, because now you're going to ask for the test and then pass it. So the test, and Miller used to put it very dramatically. He used to say this. I mean, he was teaching girls in Gateshead, right? So he used to say, the teacher walks into the classroom and she says, children, I'm going to ask you a question. Teacher, ask me. You know, you don't have this in England, but some other places you get this obnoxious, you know, precocious. It's not an English problem. Teacher, ask me. This kid always knows he's going to know the answer. That teacher's faced with an interesting problem. If she asks the kid a question that he'll answer, she'll make his problem worse. And if she asks him a difficult question that he answers, she'll make his problem much worse. She has to ask him a question that he can't answer. So when David says, Hashem, test me, he has to fail. He has to fail. Right? Because David's middah is breaking of ego to show that I'm nothing.
Yeah. The Hatzlocha was made after the failure.
So what was
it? Well, he didn't make himself fail.
So there's an opinion that he did it deliberately to teach Tshuva LeYachid. Because now that he asked for a test. Let's just try to wrap up what we're saying. We're saying like this. The day of Hoshana Rabbah is the day of the Midas HaMalchus. Malchus is that which has nothing of its own. That's what a bias is. The base of Mikdash is there to demonstrate Hashem's presence, not itself. All its beauty and greatness. And by the way, that's why the greater the base of Mikdash was, the smaller it was. The Medrash says, the original form of the base of Mikdash was a tiny little tent of skins, that's all. You know what the Medrash says? When our love was strong, we lay together on the blade of a knife. Husband and wife get married, right? When our love grew weaker, a bed of 60 cubits became too small for us. And when our love grew even weaker, Hashemayim kisi v'aretz hadam ragla. Now I sit in Shemayim and you sit down there. Rabbi Avigdor Miller always used to put it very beautifully. A couple get married initially, can't squeeze them together too tightly. They live in a tiny little basement someplace on top of each other, no problem. A couple years later, he moves into the east wing, she moves into the west wing. They still cross paths too often. And eventually, Hashemayim kisi, that's what it is. When we met Hashem originally, a tiny little tent of skins was good enough. We lay together on the blade of a knife. Then we move into Eretz Yisrael, which is a much more natural environment. No longer just Hashem and us, the Beis HaMikdash. The second bais was twice the size of the first and much emptier. No Shechin in the second. And now it's heaven and earth. The third will be a return to the first. Return to the first. But in a perfected way, where the Gashmias is not austere to the Ruchnias. So, Bais is emptiness. David is emptiness, the one who has no ego. Mashiach is emptiness, has no ego. Tefillah is making yourself empty. Standing there, I'm a vessel, that's all. Just the relationship with Hashem, and nothing of my own. Musa is emptiness. The whole work of self-development is to become empty of ego. Right? Not empty of personality, but empty. Tefillah is a carving out of an empty. It's making my Rotson so non-existent that only his. Yeah. Not I don't have a Rotson. I have a powerful, overpowering Rotson, but it's his. I've emptied mine so thoroughly that his pours into me. Wherever you cut it, that's what it is. That's what tefillah is. Hoshana Rabbah is only tefillah. It's the lips of the Rabbah. The Rabbah has nothing of its own. It's the only thing that has nothing. The Oitzah, the storehouse of reward for those who have nothing of their own is greater than all the others, says the Midrash. Because that, absolutely, that's the real Yesh. The real, Sfas Emes puts it like this. Sfas Emes says, when you do a mitzvah correctly, at that moment, you step in. You know what he says? The most amazing thing. So Asema says, well, we'll finish with this. I know it's getting late. How do you do a mitzvah? You do a mitzvah by taking a tzivoy Hashem, which is an expression of his rotzoin. He wants this thing done in the world. You then internalize it as your rotzoin, and then you do it. So here's the system. Off limits is Hashem's rotzoin for this mitzvah to be done down here. Hashem brings it all the way down in the form of a mitzvah in the Torah, and then he stops. He says, now you do it. You step in to line, you make it your rotzoin, and now you carry it out and it's done. That's called Tzelem Elokim. At that moment you become a microcosm of the whole system. At that moment you step into a pattern where your rotzoin is your point of origin, and the Maaseh is done, and you become a small reflection of the whole system, which is the identical rotzoin that Hashem has, and it gets done. So you are the cutting edge in a microcosm reflecting what the whole system is. At that moment you become part of Kibayochel. This is the deep reason why the Gemara says that Gedolei Mitzvah, the Gemara says like this, which is better? A mitzvah that is done that you mitzvah v'ose, right? Godel ha-mitzvah v'ose, yesem mi-me'esh ana mitzvah v'ose. Which is greater, a person who's mitzvah, commanded, or one who does it voluntarily? The common wisdom is spontaneous. Myself, amazing. You do it because someone tells you, very small. Moses. The person who does it because he's commanded is far greater than the one who does it spontaneously. There's many has buried. Tosfos has one. The deep explanation is this. When I do a thing spontaneously, how big is the action? The biggest can be is me. When I do an action because Hashem commands me, it's cosmic in its extent. It begins in infinity and ends with me. Godel ha-matzuva. That means the one who's mitzvah begins it. And I carry it out, I become part of reality. You can't be bigger than that. Then the Sfas Emes says, but imagine you don't do the mitzvah. Hashem brings you down to this tzibui, and you say, don't tell me what to do, this is what I'm doing. At that moment when you do the Aveira, and you step out of line, you have the most amazing feeling of personal greatness, because I'm the source of my own being. I'm deciding what I am and what I'm doing. Like Paro says, Li Yo'eriva Ni Asisi Mi, the Nile River is mine and I made me. Why does that feel good? And that's ultimate Avodah Zorah when I am. So you stand here and you say, don't want to tell me what to do. I originate my own desires and I do it. At that moment you have the most amazing feeling of personal aggrandizement and you just disappear because you just stepped out of reality. Because now there's a reality that needs to be fulfilled and you didn't do it. So you have the most amazing feeling of, yeah? And you know where that feeling comes from?
What happens to that float?
What?
What happens to that float?
It ain't there. And you're accountable. You left that piece of reality unconstructed and it was your duty and you didn't do it. You now have to pay for the avera and the lack of construction of a part of reality that you didn't do. You got that on your head as well. And by the way, why do you have this amazing feeling? Because that's who you really are. You're really capable of swelling to the proportions of Kibayochel and taking that drops and making it happen. So you have the illegitimate feeling of that when you stand on your own and you feel divine. I made me. So all these aspects are the same theme, right? Whether it's Hoshana Rabbah, which is reaching Midas HaMalchus, whether it's David, who is nothing other than an empty vessel to complete the work of Adam Rishon, Adam David Mashiach, whether it's Tefillah, which is stating your own emptiness, a self-exploration and examination that comes to a conclusion that I'm nothing, but I'm real in as much as I have a relationship with you. This is the position of the woman, which is why David is the Nukva, the female. Right? David is the female entity, that means the one who receives and gives back. That's what Malchus is. It's always called the female.
Like a facilitator?
You mean Ezek and Egle? She brings out his... She sees solid.
The facilitator is things are there, but...
Well, whatever mashal you're going to use, but the usual mashal in Chazal is it's a kli. The kli gives nothing of its own, but it gives the Beis HaMikdash is the base. What? But even that it shouldn't have. Even that it shouldn't have. Should
so the
do nothing.
Of a vessel, so there's a flaw in the mashal. It's sort of designed to take it to a certain point, but not beyond that. If one takes the mashal to its
does a wine the wine the wine the
wine shape for the job.
Yeah, the wine in the vessel has a shape.
It takes the shape of the vessel.
It's needed. The kli is needed. The computer screen's
it
needed.
The
said it. As long as it only brings out the beauty of the content, does everything that's necessary. It does an incredible job. For those who are Kabbalistic bent, I'll finish with this. This is heavy stuff, but I'll just say this: the Midas HaMalchus, which is the seventh, right, of the seven spheres. Where does it come from? Or the tenth, if you like, of ten, right? Because there's three higher ones. Where does it come from? See, here's the picture.
This is what the Sotari says. Imagine you have ten spheres, right? And the tenth is Malchus. If you look closely at it, you'll see that it's constructed in the following way. Again, this is a mind-boggling idea. You have ten, you have the highest one called Keser, you have Chochma, right? You have Bina, it's ten spheres, right? Look carefully at any of these ten, you'll see that they only have nine.
The what?
They only have nine. The tenth of them, Malchus, isn't there. It's down there. Meaning like this. The highest midah, called Keser, goes from its own Keser down to its own Malchus. Each of the ten has ten, right? Chochmah has ten, from its own Keser down to its Malchus. You look under a microscope, you see each of these ten. These ten, in fact, turn out only to be nine. Because the Midas HaMalchus is not there. It's gone down to build the Malchus down here. The next one should have 10, it's only got 9. Its Malchus is not really there. It's down here. When you get down there, you find there are 9 components to the Malchus, which none of them really are there. They're only a gift. Or each of them is only the part of each of the higher ones, right? In other words, it has mamish nothing of its own. It has nothing of its own. It's only, and of course, if you go up to each of those, and you put them under the microscope, you find that each of the 10 parts of them has 10 parts, and each of them really only has 9. Because the 10th is really only what was a gift from the ones that are higher. And no matter how far back you'll trace it, you never find the marks. It's always only the component that was contributed by something else.
The end result?
Because it's only there to demonstrate the rest of the content. It's not anything of its own. As soon as it's states its own case, it destroys itself. It must be only a transparent means to see all the else, all the others. And that's why a human being can reach dimensions of infinity if he becomes only a demonstrator of Hashem, who is infinite. To the extent that he tries to show himself, he disappears. To the extent that he tries to be a nobody and demonstrate Hashem, he becomes personally amazing. Anyway, that's an introduction to Hoshana Rabbah. There's much more to say, obviously, but the middah of the day is the day of emptiness. It is the one of the four minim that has nothing of its own. And the work, if you like, the mode of the work is tefillah, and the inner content of the work is trying to rid oneself of all content other than simply being a reflector for reality.